huge bets that it accepted with odds that now look like they'd rather not have accepted those bets, maybe it'd be a good idea for them to mark that to fair value. So I don't know why I agree is the better answer. As for what the board's intent was, I'll leave that to the board members. But if their intent was 606 should apply and not 8C, then let's put something in to make that clear.
Yeah, but we don't necessarily agree with that, Scott.
The IASB is back. We had started on the last issue because it's more of a U.S. GAAP issue. We're happy to go back and join with you on issue three if that's where you're at.
We're not anywhere at the moment. Jim said, why don't you continue with issue four?
Okay, we'll just finish this discussion. Brian?
Yeah, I think to maybe reiterate what some others have said is that now, yeah, we think with the guidance, like other industry-specific guidance, has been superseded. So now you just apply GAAP, and you would, absent some technical correction, need to evaluate whether they're derivatives or not. I can't speak to whether they. I'm not a derivative person, so I don't know. And if that, I think to Scott's question, I think it is kind of a interesting question. If I place a fixed odds wager that the Cleveland Cavaliers are going to win the NBA championship in the fall, and LeBron blows out his knee, I mean, why wouldn't he 15 give the better accounting answer? I'm not sure why we're leaping to, well, let's wait until they lose in the first round.
Yeah, I guess including in that, and I'm not saying this is worse accounting, but presumably taking the day one game or sort of any VIG that you might charge or a question of, and then I guess in thinking whether you want sort of the revenue disclosures or derivative disclosures, including for table games that, of course, don't have the same feature. They're closing out immediately, although I guess they would be in the scope of still the derivative disclosures in terms of volume of activity and gross flows. Whether that is sort of a more useful presentation to investors versus treating these as your revenue line item. The other interesting thing would be, as I understand it, I think casinos in the U.S. or tribal nation financial reporting that might fall under GASB reporting, I think, is accounting for these as revenue. I don't think this would change the scope at all of GASB accounting, and I think in some circumstances the same entity has to report both under GASB standards and FASB standards. So whether that would be sort of a useful exercise for them to need to keep two sets of books and records and report, again, all of which we might want to look at. I just not clear to me that that's what the board was wouldn't hear when we debated the issue, but whether that's what we would have intended. Brett.
Yeah, just to maybe add on a few thoughts that's what's already been said. I think it was also the board's intent to try to eliminate industry practice and to converge with IFRS, and I think so sort of following what intent is difficult, which is I think speaks to need to probably clarify this area. Sometimes when you say you're not no longer in revenue, people think, well, that means I have to present something as something other than revenue. I think that's it's the same thing you tell a bank that's just earning interest income. You're not in the scope of 606. You still have interest revenue, obviously. And so it may be that the presentation isn't very different. Maybe some different disclosures. Frankly, maybe disclosures are less onerous if you're in derivative accounting than perhaps in revenue. I'm not sure. But I think the thing that's worth thinking through, too, is, there's a lot of aspects of 606 that may be difficult to navigate. Like, I think it's clear in the casino audit guide that you present your net gaming revenue net, which is what I think the derivative accounting would be as well. I'm not so sure how I would apply the principal agent guidance and the revenue standard to evaluating whether that bet would with the gambler is in fact gross or net. I'm just not sure how I would go about that, which may speak to having to provide more guidance around, okay, if you're in 606 and you're a casino, here's how it's gonna play out. So, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not certain that the real the arbitrage in accounting is just the open bet, the open positions at a balance sheet date. I say just. I mean, I think it depends on how significant that is to a casino. But other than that, I would think the net revenue presentation is more or less identical. Maybe labeled different, perhaps, but I just don't think it's a huge difference in outcome. But
I think the timing could be depending on
the timing on open positions.
Yeah,
yeah.
The other issue is netting the promotional expenses, which is would not be done in derivatives account.
Well, I think there's a view on the staff anyway that you no longer do that under 606 either.
Right. I mean, by being within the scope of 606, follow the guidance in 606, regardless of what the old industry guidance used to allow you to do.
And there is an AICPA task force that is addressing some of those issues around what are the performance obligations in the arrangement, assuming that the accounting for these types of transactions would be under the scope of 606. So some of those issues are being thought through by that group.
And I guess even if the conclusion is it falls under 815, at least in terms of part of the arrangement or contract, there will be portions for which you'll have to evaluate 606. So you may have two pieces of literature. That is, if you're earning material rights as you're playing at the casino, presumably you're going to have to evaluate, do I need to do some accounting for the comps that are earned as I'm entering into, if they were derivative transactions, and is that portion of the transaction under 606? So you have sort of
I thought through that too. I thought actually, you know, like the credit card scenario, if in fact the base transaction is out of scope, then if I'm earning loyalty rewards based on more worth someone's betting, and perhaps that's sort of out of scope of 606 as well. On the other hand, if I'm earning loyalty points, as I'm saying, in hotels that are owned by the casino, it's different, but yeah, I think that's
so then, yeah, I mean, which could, not saying it's not the right path to head down, but then a complicating factor of which loyalty, you know, you're earning the same account, whether it's staying at the hotel or eating the food or doing the gambling, so people can do it, but you need a system, I guess, to then sort of track those under two accounting models. Daryl?
I just wanted to understand a little bit better from those who may be advocating some clarity being provided in this area. Just wanted to understand the nature of the clarity that you might be requesting, whether you're asking that there be some clarifying language inserted that would specifically deal with fixed odds wagering contracts, which then I think would beg the question potentially if other types of gray area contracts get identified later on down the road, then we would also then potentially be providing more specific exclusion for specific types of facts and circumstances, or are you advocating that we could provide clarity in a more general principled way that would help potentially with this and anything else like this that might be identified later?
I was similar to what Scott said. I think that we had thought that absent any further clarification and gaps, that people would look at the contract, they would look to other areas of gap, like the derivatives literature. And while I'm not a derivatives expert either, our derivative experts in our firm have indicated that they think that they probably would be accounted for as derivatives. So it would seem as though if there's a technical correction to be made, consistent with what Scott was saying before, having that technical correction be made in the derivative literature to scope these transactions out of that literature would be helpful, because then you would be evaluating them under 606, and the scope guidance in 606, where you have to think about whether there's other things in the scope of other standards, that other guidance would now tell you, okay, we've looked at 815, it's scoped out, so bring it back around.
Daryl, to your question specifically, I would advocate very specific guidance. Normally, obviously, we want to write principles-based guidance here, but if I boil the staff's paper down to a principle, the principle is we didn't mean to change that. I don't think we can write that principle into the literature. So I think we have to be very specific.
Well, I guess I don't know that there's a specific scope exception today from 815 for these, other than a practice, and after that, some guidance developed by an industry group that came after 815. So I'm not sure how that exactly developed either. Mark?
Yeah, to that point, and I think that's what I was going to say, I mean, I don't know whether you amend 815. It's maybe you stick it 924, 815, or 606, whatever it is, bringing back what was the language that was in there before might be enough. A little more clarity might be helpful so that we don't have to talk about this in 10 years again. I hear some sort of leaning towards derivative accounting. All of my outreach that I've done to the casinos saying, you want to keep consistent application, consistent financial statements within this industry. I would not want to get into a diversity where some are saying, well, this is a derivative and this isn't, and some of these bets are and some of these aren't. I don't think the model that they use today is broke, and I don't know why we would try to break it. So there's a way to clarify it. I don't know whether this is enough, that the FASB said it wasn't their intent to break this. But I guess if you want to go to 815, I would suggest doing a lot more outreach and talking to the casinos and what the implications are. Like Allison said, we're working through it at the AICPA on a lot of these issues. I think we'll get some reasonable answers, standard. And some things will change, but making them all derivatives hopefully is not one of them.
The FASB, I don't think, made any decisions about this. They made decisions to get rid of industry guidance and didn't foresee this particular issue. And the staff has made statements in this paper about what they believe the outcome would be. But the FASB never, to my recollection, deliberated this issue.
You know, just to add to Mark's point, I do think, as the boards think about it, if the decision is to head towards 815, I think that's probably far more outreaching, and you probably need to do a lot more outreach to determine what are the other unintended consequences of that answer. So 606 sounds like a simple answer, but if the board decides 815 is the route to go, I really would encourage more outreach.
Anyone else? So I would summarize this as more clarity would be useful to you all. Ian, I think that takes us back to issue.
Are you still there, Jim?
Ian, can you hear us?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Okay. So we would summarize in the U.S. issue four as people generally looking for greater clarity as to 815 or derivative accounting versus revenue within the scope of 606. I think, Brett, you make a good point. Is either way, it doesn't preclude you from the top line. But greater clarity is what people were asking for here, which gets us back to issue three. Scott, I think you're teeing up.
I am. All right. So turning out issue three, TRG agenda paper 45 discusses a few additional application questions that have arisen with respect to licensed intellectual property in recent months. The agenda paper is organized into four issues. The staff think it would be beneficial to the discussion if we attempt to segment the discussion into first, the discussion of issue one about the timing of recognition for revenue attributable to a renewal of a time-based right to use license, followed by a discussion together of issues two and three that are both fundamentally about identifying attributes of a single license versus identifying the promised goods and services in the contract. And finally, a discussion of issue four that is a more specific application question on customer options to add users, seats, copies of software. Before we jump into issue number one, the staff wants to highlight a couple key themes that run through the discussion of and affect all of the issues in this paper. First, it's important to remember that the licensing implementation guidance applies the model in the new revenue standard. It does not replace it. For example, the implementation guidance about what are attributes of a license or the implementation guidance on accounting for sales or usage-based fees does not change in any of these requirements to identify the promised goods or services in the contract when assessing its performance obligations as part of step two of the model. Nor should the implementation guidance result in a customer option to acquire a license being accounted for differently from a customer option to acquire any other good. The second key theme is that the new revenue standard establishes that a customer does not obtain control of the license before the beginning of the period during which it can use and benefit from the licensed intellectual property. And therefore, the licensor's performance to transfer control of a license to the customer includes not only the requirement to deliver a copy of the IP, but also to deliver or grant those rights, because the customer controls the rights, not the IP itself. In other words, the new revenue standard establishes, through paragraphs 60610, 5563, which is B61 in IFRS 15, and as explained in BC 414, that the licensor has not transferred control of a license before it has both made available a copy of the IP and granted the rights under the license. These two themes sort of permeate the staff's analysis of what we believe the new standard requires with respect to each issue. So, turning to issue one, paragraph 20 of the CRG paper outlines what we term example A. Two parties entering a three-year license, the term of which ends on December 31st, 20X3. On June 30th, 20X3, the parties agree a contract to renew the license for three more years beginning on January 1st, 20X4. Some stakeholders expressed the view, which is view A in the paper, that the renewal revenue should be recognized on January 1st, 20X4, which is the start of the renewal period. Those stakeholders think the guidance in paragraph 5563, or B61, stating that the licensor cannot recognize revenue before the beginning of the period during which the customer can use and benefit from the license, supports that view. Other stakeholders have expressed the view, which is B in the paper, that the renewal revenue should be recognized on June 30th, 20X3, when the renewal is agreed between the parties. That paragraph 5563, B61, speaks to an initial license only because in a renewal of the license, the customer already controls the license. Thinking to one of the key themes that was described, in the case of a renewal, the entity has no further performance to undertake. It has already both provided a copy of the intellectual property and granted the rights in the license because the customer is already using and benefiting from those same rights. As expressed in paragraph 26 of the paper, the staff thinks UB is the most consistent with the guidance in the new revenue standard. With that, I'll turn the discussion over to the CRG of issue one.
Comments?
So on issue one, as I was reading through the staff analysis and the conclusion, I followed everything and agreed with the conclusion there. And as I thought about this, the standard as it was exposed with the most recent exposure draft would clarify that restrictions on time, geographic region, and use should be ignored. And so this being a restriction related to time, you ignore that. So then the accounting model as described by the staff makes a lot of sense. I found myself questioning that, however, when I got to issue two, and I appreciate that we're not discussing issue two, but I did at least just want to say that overall, distinguishing situations when time, geographic use are really attributes of a license, and when they really should be thought of as a performance obligation, that tends to be difficult. And we're finding around the globe as we socialized this issue that we're getting lots of different views to both issue one and issue two in terms of what people think is the right answer. And so, again, looking, if we were to peek ahead to issue two, people might then view issue one and say, well, adding an additional time increment, that is granting an additional right. And so that is obviously what's under view A. And I think people could reasonably come to that view under the standard as well.
So you're, this might be making it, your point, I think, is this might be oversimplifying it, but we seem to be treating time differently in issue two than issue one. We say all of these things are not features of the license, but then when you add one later, we say those are separate, but when you add time later, it becomes a feature of the initial license. Is that your
And so why is time different?
That's the struggle. And again, with our network around the globe, we're finding a lot of difficulty with people coming to consistent answers.
Brett?
Yeah, I guess maybe a little bit on...
You know, Brad, Ryan, it's almost the same.
Who?
Oh. Go ahead, Brett.
Oh.
Now it's so funny.
So, I guess what I was going to say, you may be along Allison's line, is the analysis in issue one seems a little inconsistent with what the thinking was under issue two and three. Here, the customer, the first license, established the right to use for a period of time. So, an extension of that period of time to us seems like that's outside the scope of the original license. So in our view, we were thinking the original license had boundaries to its scope of use, and any change in those boundaries subsequently as a result of a negotiation agreement with the customer would kind of by definition be a new and different license. So that would lead you down the path of considering whether it was a modification and so forth. We do like the outcome of that the staff come to in the paper, but we really only look at paragraph 25 of the paper, providing some basis of what was discussed earlier and in the basis for the conclusion or support review B and things like that is flawed.
So, yeah, I think, we tend to agree with the staff's analysis in the first question. I think we struggled as we got into the second and third issue. Honestly, I think it seems like the standard, or at least that's being reformulated in terms of these disclosure drafts, seem to be sending mixed messages around this whole license area, and I think on probably two dimensions. One is there's sort of a view of, look, I performed and I've delivered the rights and somebody can begin using them. So any of those restrictions that I put on that customer, that licensee, are just attributes. They're going to define what the license boundaries are, but I've conveyed the rights to that individual, and they stand to benefit from the risks and rewards of ownership of that IP as defined on day one, basically. So I have that notion about performance, and then I have the sort of notion about conveying value to my customer. So if I'm focused on conveying value because I have to wait for the date, I delivered the software key, or I delivered the digits, the film, or whatever. That becomes an important gating issue, and those two sort of ideas create tension, I think, in the model. And I'd say the other area where I think there seems to be some tension is the license guidance, the either right to use or right to access, coupled with the exception for sales and usage-based royalties, feels like a parallel part of the model. Feels like it's separate from the rest of the model. Yet we keep going back to, well, they could have been distinct, and they could, we keep thinking of them as potentially as additional options or optional purchases. I think the minute you start doing that, you kind of mix the concepts. It's hard to make it work. So I personally wonder if it would be better to sort of stick and figure out which path you want to head down and stick with that path. Because right now it feels like the principle that restrictions don't determine performance obligations doesn't jive particularly well with the examples where, in fact, it seems to be driving performance obligations.
Are you envisioning a circumstance, though, where are you effectively saying that the board should pick one or the other and there should be no judgment? So time is always a attribute, which means it shouldn't really impact much at all, or it's never an attribute?
I guess I would never say no judgment. The point I'm making is either the model is, it's all about, conveying performance, it's reporting performance. I perform by delivering you functional IP that's fully functional, I have nothing further to do, and I put restrictions on you, and those restrictions don't really determine anything other than how you're going to use they're going to set the price, obviously, you're going to affect the value, but you have the rights immediately. There's sort of that model. Or there's a model that says, no, I'm looking for value to my, sort of like an operating lease model. I own the IP still, and I'm just letting you use it in certain bits and pieces. And as you use it, I'm gonna reflect my performance. That's a different different analysis, I think, than the first one. I think the first one's about conveying value, about transferring control over the value on day one.
See, where I get confused, and one of the things we're trying to highlight is, again, whether you agree with it or not, if we had a blank sheet of paper, that's a different story. This has created, and again, this is relatively consistent with DPA 70 today, is that we've said that, you know, giving you the functional IP, let's say in this case, is not when the customer obtains control of the license. It is the point in time at which they can begin to start using and benefiting from it. So in an initial license, whether it's today or tomorrow, the notion is, if I've given you a copy of the software on June 30th, and this is not the renewal scenario, this is a new scenario, on June 30th, but you can't use it till 1-1, you don't recognize the revenue until 1-1. I think most people would agree that's pretty clear that that's what the standard requires, right or wrong. And it's that those two pieces of performance that differ when we think about the time scenario, that distinction that we're drawing, and to be fair, we've had certain discussions with people that highlight that distinction. And the difference is, you're already, I don't have to grant you those rights. If you view the standard as requiring the granting of those rights, there's nothing new for me to grant if you're already controlling and using those rights. And that's the difference we draw, since people are drawing a distinction between one and two, between issue one and issue two, is that the standard requires that you make available the intellectual property and that the customer can use and benefit from those rights. When I'm merely changing the time attribute of that license, I don't have to do either of those things again. If you have additional distinct rights being granted, you have to do one of those again. You have to actually grant the rights that the customer has never controlled to that point if they are distinct and separate.
So that, and I appreciate, I struggle with this too. I think that distinction is perhaps almost too subtle for human understanding in some terms. You know, and so I've characterized it as why, and because we said so. I mean, why is time different? Because we said so. Not because we can come up with some outstanding underlying theory, because of course you are granting additional rights when you're granting additional time. And those additional rights, if we head down this path, you just say, well, they're different. And I think we can try and articulate the basis, but it might also be, if that's where we head, is, you know, accept the basis is because we said time is different.
And just what I wanted to point out, though, is just the difficulty, the operationality of trying to make divine that line the perfect line. I understand why there's a gating issue around when the customer can begin benefiting from license rights. I would submit that actually, even if I have a post-dated right, you know, like a sell-by date, I sell a book to a bookstore and have a sell-by date, that in theory the books, I've transferred control, and, you know, I think in a physical sense, a tangible world, we wouldn't struggle that much with the fact that I've sold the books, even though I have a, you know, 3-month forward sell-by date. So in this case, with IP, we've created this gating issue around a, you know, first use date. But I guess the question is, do you want to expand even further and say, and now I'm going to look into the license and look to, you know, and sort of subdivide the license. And that's what's concerning. And I had an example, not in this paper, but one where that I shared with some folks around a usage restriction that says, you know, it's not uncertain usage. I spelled out in the license that the customer can use it, you know, 1,500 times in year one, 2,500 times in year two, and 3,000 times in year three. And, you know, same IP, I've conveyed it all on up front, the 3-year term, but it has usage restrictions in each of those 3 years. And I got back answers saying, well, that's just a usage restriction, so ignore it, record all the revenue up front, it's functional IP. You know, and the second answer was, well, I'm going to look to the beneficiary and licensee, in this case, only use 1,500 in the first year, so maybe I should look and model it based on licensee, which feels like a usage-based royalty, but this is not uncertain. And then the third answer is, no, you have to actually subdivide that into a 3-year license for 1,500, a 2-year license for 1,000 installations, and a 1-year license for 500. Record each of those 3 licenses on the beginning date of the first, you know, I just think we're kind of going down this rabbit hole that is really difficult to navigate. So,
Greg?
Yeah, just a couple of comments, similar to what some of them are just similar to what Brett had said. I mean, while I can see the conclusion that the staff reached, I actually was surprised when I read this paper, because it was not a conclusion that I had been totally focused on. First of all, the reference to existing gap, PPA 71, I think, or 70, has been superseded. So, you know, it's not necessarily clear that you would go back to superseded U.S. gap and provide that as a conclusion. And I also think that there, you know, a reasonable person might look at this and not get to this conclusion absent this CRG discussion and this paper, because many people that I've talked to in the software industry say, okay, 71 was superseded. We're talking here now about software licenses that we transfer to a client transfer control. Many in the industry have felt that the extension or renewal of license rights is an action that the supplier or vendor has to take, right? Because in absence of that renewal
by the supplier, the client is in violation of the initial license arrangement. Right, so I mean, I think it was not totally clear that this guidance.
Right. Hold on just a second, we're getting
much clearer now.
Right.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Okay. I don't think it was totally clear that you would also assume, again, absence of the paper, that this guidance would apply to renewals. The other thing, as was said, I think, by both Allison and Brett, and we have the same concern, is that this conclusion in issue one is not necessarily consistent to the other issues raised in the paper. And we need to kind of think through that. And lastly, just operationally, as a software provider, this provides a wealth of opportunity for software companies who sign up customers for multi-year term licenses to, whenever they have a shortfall in revenue, just to go out and sign up renewals, not change the client payment terms, not change anything, but just book more revenue way in advance of the effective license period. Now, while that is similar to guidance today, as we said, I think under the new standard, we should recognize that more licenses are going to be recognized up front, and this type of guidance could potentially be more impactful in the industry.
First, I would say, I mean, I agree with the other comments. I do think there's some tension between one and two, but for all the same reasons, I'm not going to repeat them. I did have one question, though, about this example. And we're talking about IP, and it refers to, say, 2 years out, you know, they grant a new license. Oftentimes, that license has been updated. There's been modifications, et cetera. The example is silent to that point. And I was just curious from the staff's perspective, does that mean modifications to license don't really impact the decision because you're getting them anyway, or do you need to consider that, or is that something you didn't want to clutter up with the example?
I think it would be unfair to say that we ran through those different variations in here. But I think implied to this, and some people here have seen our continuing work on the final ASU for this, it would be the, when you're granting, this is in the context of, I'm granting you the same rights. You had a 3-year license and I'm renewing that same license. We get into a different question. If this has all sorts of bells and whistles to it, there's also, just like today, you know, if there's additional deliverables, you know, I'm granting you a specified upgrade along with the promise to renew the license you already have. None of this takes away your obligation to now account for a new multiple element arrangement.
You know, I would just add to it then, granted there probably are examples where you're just extending what you have today, but there's probably a lot more examples where there's been modifications to what you have today, and I think that might even be more like the more common example, so just throw that out.
Others here? Ian?
Okay. Any comments here? Christoph?
Pretty much in line what was said over in the US, I struggle with making different issue one and issues 2 to 4, so to treat the time different from other features of the license. I think in particular, if you compare paragraph 34 in the paper and paragraph 26 in the paper, the contradiction becomes obvious. And when these are the paragraphs that are supposed to show a subtle difference between them, to me they rather show the contradiction. Because in one of the paragraphs it said that these are distinct, separate performance obligations, separate licenses, while in 26 it's something the customer has the access already, and that's why it would be an extension. Now, why is it an extension if it's an extension by time and not if it is one by geography? So I struggle to see the difference. I wonder how the stuff should be applied to licenses that customers receive, where they can choose whether there is for an additional seat or an additional period, if we start to treat periods and seats differently. I also agree that the license start date as a trigger for recognizing revenue is important. I think a lot of structuring would occur if that wasn't the case, pretty much along the lines of what was said earlier. You simply do multi-year licenses with extended payment terms and get to where you want to be. And that's why I think we need to get to something that treats time in the same manner than other features of the license, like geography or other features, or better explain why time should be a different feature.
Thank you. Can I just clarify, Christoph? So would you view, therefore, adding additional time but not changing the underlying rights, would you view that as being effectively distinct, those additional time rights? So in other words, I have a 3-year license. We negotiate to add a 1-year extension of that. It doesn't modify the rights at all, just extends it in time. Would you just therefore view that as being effectively?
It depends on what corner you want to go. It depends on what corner you want to go to. But to say I extend it by 1 year or I extend it by one region, I struggle to find the principle that would tell me that these should be two different things.
Kazu.
Yes. Thank you. Well, originally I thought view A, view B is convincing, but the more I read and discuss with my colleagues, I kind of support the view A. It's simply because it's consistent with the standard or guidance in B61 that revenue can't be recognized until you start using it. So it is simply consistent. I kind of disagree with some points in the view B arguments, like trying to analogize that license to a goods, which is a little bit different. If license with a certain term period doesn't fit into model of the goods, because it's a right to use the goods for a certain time, so it's kind of lease of the goods. So I think it's more leaning toward arguing that this license for a certain period is more this kind of distinct performance obligation. So and also I disagree with the argument in paragraph 25 when you cancel the license of the software. You need to uninstall the software. You can't use anymore from that after the cancellation. You need to, if you want to continue to use, you need to purchase again, which is economically makes sense. Or you need to purchase for the extension for that period. You need to wait until that effective date comes, while you can. After you cancel. So there are a lot of some inconsistency or unclear arguments here. So I just need to clarify further, I think.
The menu up.
So like Cass said, I think one way of looking at it is considering the transaction as a sale of a right to use the license over 3 years. So renewing it is actually another transaction, which is selling another right to use the underlying IP. And Second, I don't think there is so much a contradiction with what was said about attributes, because my understanding is that attributes are really useful for one transaction, but here we are talking about a new transaction, so time here can still be considered as qualifying for a new transaction rather than an attribute to the first license.
James?
Ian, in reading issue one, I was happy to get to view B if one placed some reliance on modification accounting, but the key thing to me was in 24, where they highlight that time was merely an attribute to the license, and reading that with 26, where the customer already controls. Those to me were the crux of view B. If that's the case, and I know I'm going ahead, I start getting a different sense when I read issue two, especially in para 34, where we're saying the customer now doesn't control. I think the original license gave them the control, but couldn't start in a particular jurisdiction. I couldn't understand why geography and time were being treated differently, either their attributes or their rights, and I think that's where the consistency must come through.
I've sort of felt some unease about this from a bit of going back a couple of meetings. It's not just the renewal issue, it's sort of other issues. I can see that if control switches to the customer and then they do a number of things over a subsequent period, then you have this sort of point of time upfront recognition of the sales. But having read this and listened to the comments again, I'm still uneasy. It's partly because the sort of ability to use and benefit from on the part of the customer seems quite important, although that's not, that's presumably superseded by change of control. The distinction between changing attributes and making no additional promises also seems to be quite a fine one. And just thinking about this upfront recognition, I suppose my fundamental question is, does this have to be a point in time recognition as opposed to over time? So, for example, if you give somebody the right to use something over 3 years, and you therefore can't sell it again to somebody else. So, if we're thinking about forecasting the cash flows of the vendor's cash flows, the amount and timing, it just doesn't feel quite right that something that looks like an annuity is just bang, sort of upfront sale. But I think this may be one I've lost on, and I know Henry's explained to me that once if somebody gains control of something and then they can use it as and where and when they like, and that's what happens with things that people buy. But somehow it just doesn't feel quite right.
Tony,
I probably share all of the things that James said. I think, if I'm answering question one specifically against the principle that restrictions do not affect the number of performance obligations, then I think the logic flows quite nicely and gets to the same answer that the staff did. But I find it much more difficult when we move on to question two and trying to understand why a restriction on time is different to a restriction on usage or a restriction on geography. I think somebody in Connecticut said that distinction is rather too fine to be understood, and I think I'm probably in the same camp.
Philip.
Yeah, so I agree with everything everyone said, which seems to be very consistent. It seems to me that there's underneath all of this, there's a sort of unit of account issue where we're not really sure whether something is a single thing or multiple things, and we're not sure whether time is a divider of things into different units of account, or whether geography is a divider of things into different units of account. Obviously, this first example, although it's about point-in-time licenses, is focusing particularly on software, and maybe there's an implication that software might be something that you tend to use on a continuous basis. Of course, this is wider than just software. This would also apply to things like TV rights licensing, where actually there may be big gaps between when you can use something and when you can next use it. And some people have said so far they get the impression that geography is different from time. That's the impression I get too, though I'm not sure what the basis for that difference is. But then I'm also not sure even if time is treated consistently. I think I've seen a suggestion elsewhere that the right to show a particular film every December might be a single license, and yet every other December might not be a single license, and yet there are gaps in both cases. And I'm just deeply confused by this topic.
Andrew.
Thank you. I think I share the unease of others when we look at the time attributes and geographic ones. I can see how the logic in the paper works, and I think that on issue one, if you were saying that the licensed software is exactly the same as it was before, and all you've done is change the dates in the contract, so the contract goes out further, then based on what the standard says at the moment, it would seem difficult not to be in the staff view. The difficulty I have, though, is when you look at the guidance around time-based licenses, and maybe I could illustrate it by a slightly different but very simple example, that I would license someone software which qualifies for point-in-time recognition. It's a three-year license, and I give them credit. So they pay me 12 months in advance at the start of each year. What I also do is I give them a software key at the start of each 12-month period. Now, if I look at the way some people read this, some would say, ah, well, because you're giving people the key, if I go to B61, B61 says that's something which will block revenue recognition until you give them the key. One thing I have heard from the earlier conversation, though, is the view that that guidance in B61 would only apply for the first key and subsequent keys, because whoever's using the software as a licensee has already got the software and is already using it, then you wouldn't worry about the need for provision for further keys. Depending on the answer to that question, you've got some very interesting structuring issues around. So I'm a little bit troubled by that. I think when I get onto issue two, I can see a distinction between the two different licenses. And perhaps it is based around the same type of B61 argument, that what you're looking at with some of this licensing that's being provided is that although you've got it as a customer, you're simply unable to use it until you get to a particular date.
But you're the first one that's found that distinction, that you understand it. What was your point again? Can you just make your...
The first one or the second one?
Okay.
The one in issue two.
On the difference between geography and time.
Well, I'm not sure there necessarily is one.
Okay, so you agree with everybody else.
So I think I agree with others. I don't necessarily see that there's a principle there that means that there's a difference between the time-based attributes and the geographic one.
So it's on the circumstances of issue one and issue two.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Philippe.
Well, when I first read the fact pattern, I came to the conclusion that UA was appropriate. Then I put some attention to the staff's attention, and I was okay with UB. But what Emmanuel said just a moment ago is important, because it is all based on the idea that the customer already controls the rights which are inferred to him by the license. But those rights will end as of the end of the first period. They will return to the licensor, and the new contract give again, maybe the same rights, maybe not different. But this new transaction just changes the nature of this, not the benefits to the customer, but it creates a new control, not the old one. So I think that UA has some merits too. It's not easy.
Mary?
It's a different way of asking a question for understanding the differences, and it is a question, which is, if we have said that time is an attribute of the item being licensed, then how can it be that the customer already has control of the item when it has received the item that ends, you know, with the original license term. If time is an attribute of that item, then they don't have the item that includes the extension. And I'm not trying to ask existential questions. I'm trying to see, are we being consistent with our assertion that time is an attribute of the item? And if not, is that maybe the reason that people are struggling with trying to see the difference between the first question and the second question? I also noted a difference that I think somebody else picked up between the analysis in paragraph 24 applying the modification accounting guidance that just says on the last sentence, next to last sentence, a renewal or extension is not a distinct good or service. Well, in the geography, the conclusion is that it is a distinct good or service. And I know we're just discussing the first one, but understanding why that different conclusion is reached about something being distinct or not, I think would be helpful for people in terms of seeing the difference between time and geography.
Gary?
Simplicity, Mary, on that last point. I mean, I guess it's saying that in the second example, one can evaluate the contract as containing distinct geographies.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if you have one geography and you add another geography, you've added a distinct right. In the time example, you have viewed it, I mean, that the model with a right to use license is viewing the period of time as having really no impact in terms of the pattern of revenue recognition, but the time is just an attribute. Therefore, that was the distinction. You wouldn't have broken that up into separate performance obligations for each of those time periods. And therefore, that was kind of the distinction between the time and the geography.
Would you have broken up the geography?
Well,
I mean, if they'd both been granted
I'm sure we're going to hear views to say that you have a single license there with restrictions built into it. So that's the tension, effectively, is between effectively identifying what are the separate promised goods and services, the performance obligation, versus what is an attribute of a single license.
But I still don't fully understand why time's an attribute and geography's distinct.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was viewing that the first issue similarly to how Scott was explaining, in terms of saying you're not getting additional rights, you already control those rights, and you're just changing the attributes of what you already have.
So why can't you argue that for geography?
Because I effectively evaluated the contract as containing separate promises in that.
But Philippe would say that you had a new contract and then you get a new contract.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I understand that argument.
By the way, I would add that where you sell upfront or recognize revenue upfront, whether the contract is for 2, 5, or 10 years, it will not be priced the same way. Probably the time element of that contract creates something which is important in the pricing.
Gary.
But taking issues 1 and 2 together, I actually have no issue with, in fact, support where the staff is on each one, but only in a vacuum. I think if we collectively conclude that there is no distinction between time and geography, then we had to pick one. I would probably opt more towards view B, it as opposed to, the staff conclusion in issue 2, to be clarified, assuming we think that really time and geography really have to hold together. I think from trying to explain this to a non-financial business executive, I think the staff recommendations in both issue 1 and issue 2 are more consistent. I think issue 1, where it's 3 years, sometime during the first 3-year cycle you extend it, trying to tell an executive that, you know, you got to wait till the next renewal period begins. They say, well, I'm just continuing what I already had. I could have wrote a 6-year contract in the first instance and booked 6 years of revenue up front. I think that would be hard to be understood I think on the other hand, we go to issue two when Japan or new product line kicks in a few years down the line, they'll understand, well, it's going to be a few years before I start seeing revenue or my customer's customer can start using this, and therefore the revenue flows are more consistent with the ultimate usage pattern. I can see that too. So I can see both individually existing. If we decided, because either these are highly subtle distinctions that we can't clearly articulate that the world can grasp and easily run with, so when we get there, I would probably go towards the staff view in issue two, is the dot which would say there is no distinction between geography and time.
Okay. Jake.
Thank you, Ian. I think this sort of builds on the point that Mary was making, which is if you say that time is purely an attribute of the license, then notwithstanding what various bits of the standard say, I don't think you should get to a different answer when you just extend a license or you actually sell a license that will start in a few years' time. If you're saying this is just an attribute of the license and they have everything else they need to benefit from that, then control has transferred. So why would you, in principle, end up in a different place?
Jane?
I'm sorry, I didn't put it down.
I was just going to respond to something Henry said a moment ago about the extension of time not being distinct. I think it's only not distinct because we're kind of invoking the sort of series idea in para 22b. I mean, actually, since we're apparently granting term licenses, it seems as though individual terms are perfectly capable of being distinct. So it doesn't seem a compelling argument to me to say that that's a different thing in nature. It's not really. It's just that we're tending to stick them together for convenience a lot of the time.
Lee, can you see you down there?
Yeah, I just thought it would be worth putting a point across because we don't often in IOSCO get opinions one way or the other, and I think this paper is one of those instances where. It's certainly with issue one, A or B could be supported, but the real distinction between that and the others was not necessarily clear to everybody. So I think I would like to support the discussions that others have brought to the table, which is if there is that distinction between view A and B on issue one, the rationale for why that's different to the others would require a bit of better explanation if we were to be able to enforce it. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. I think that's it, Jim. Just about everybody on that one.
We had a couple more comments here, Jim Schnurr and Alan Cohen, I think.
I think part of the issue here is that the point-in-time model actually seems to ignore time. And therefore, once you gain control, or the customer gains control, time is not an attribute anymore. Whereas when it comes to something like geography, so if I give Furious 7 to Netflix, for example, to use, and I give it to them in France and Germany, if it's the license period starts and ends at the same time, well, they have the right to use it, it doesn't really matter. If in France they have the right to use that license for 2 years, but in Germany their license doesn't start to 2 years out, should I be recognizing all that revenue in for Germany when they have the product? They're not going to return the product that they got from France to me. All they have to do is put it on their server for Germany, but that license period hasn't started yet. And I think that's the tension here. It's this point-in-time model we have that's causing a lot of these tensions.
In terms of looking at this particular issue, I think it's when you have a situation where you have, let's say, when you have a distinct license, you enter into it for, let's say, a 1-year period. Let's say 6 months later you go out and you renegotiate, and it could go to a competitor. So instead of going to Netflix, it goes to Amazon. The idea that if you renew with Netflix, you get immediate, but if you go to Amazon, you have to wait until that period starts, just doesn't seem to make sense.
My listening to the conversation is, I think there's a lot of moving parts where people are trying to put it all together. But listening, I think the key point is we've talked about restrictions as the point that overrides the rest other aspects of the model. And we've said that restrictions are aspects of defining the rights in the contract. It would seem to me if you change your restrictions, you've got new rights. If that's how we're going to be describing restrictions, whether it's a point in time or otherwise, which would suggest that it would not be that you would treat them this similarly over time. And that would be the issue two conclusion for issue one.
It seems to me, anyway, part of the problem is exactly what Jim said, that there isn't a well-understood principle here. And I've heard a number of TRG members request that there be one, but we don't know what that principle is such that everyone could follow it. I see Larry making a face, but I couldn't tell you exactly what the principle is such that everyone could understand it. And so if we focus specifically on issue one, whether you're in the A camp or the B camp, there's a lot of structuring that could go on either way. So the staff happened to support view B, but a number of you said, well, that would facilitate a lot of structuring. There's a much easier structuring opportunity if you follow view A, which is when you get 1 year into a three-year contract, you just modify it. You cancel the contract and you enter into a new contract for the remaining term plus. And that gets you to a totally different answer. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I'm not sure there is going to be a perfect answer here, and I don't think there is going to be an answer that everyone conceptually agrees with. I think it's going to boil down to trying our best to make sure that there's consistency, if we stick to issue one, that there's consistency with respect to applying this issue. And one way that we can do that is to have an example in our final ASU that says this is what the answer is. And we can debate whether that's right or wrong or should be improved, but we could at least get consistency in applying the answer.
There's one thing, the funny part is as we have this discussion, just, hopefully I'm not speaking entirely over Henry, but as we go through this, it's not like we as staff had any impression that writing this paper would have a unanimous kumbaya moment because of what Cullen was more or less saying here, that there are ways to look at the principles. But there are a couple things that I feel like aren't getting drawn out, and that's probably means that when we drafted the paper, we didn't draw them out enough or they weren't getting hit on. They at least were trying to circle around. We have been pretty clear, whether it's in the issued guidance or whether it was in the exposure draft. And again, the exposure draft, people shouldn't assume that the drafting in the public exposure draft is what will be in the final ASU. Things often have a way of changing based on the comment letters and other feedback we get. But the point that was always being made is that restrictions of a license are attributes of that license. That does not change the fact that, first of all, just logically, you're going through the performance obligations guidance to first figure out that you're even going to the licensing guidance. You have to have identified that there is a promised license before you're going to go to the licensing guidance at all to consider what it says about restrictions of a license. So one of the struggles we had is there is a tension. Somebody mentioned, I think it was in London, about the unit of account issue. You're absolutely correct. People are saying, oh, well, restrictions of a license don't matter. That's absolutely correct. But that assumes you've decided that the entire contract is a single license. And that's sort of what has been a tension point in discussions with many people, taking the examples in issue two, is that you might conclude that there are two licenses there. So yes, the restrictions on each license don't affect or change those promised goods or services, but it does not necessarily go in order. You have to look at, we have pretty clear step two guidance that tells you to think about the promises in the contract. And there is some tension there. Can a reasonable person come through and might say, oh, well, that's a single license with restrictions. But is that necessarily the only answer, the only answer we've heard? No. So there is a question about thinking about restrictions of a license do not affect that license, but that paragraph doesn't tell you how many licenses you have. one of the other key distinctions that we were trying to draw, just again, not to say that the distinction was either right or the way it should have to be applied, but just because it's clear, one of the distinctions between time and the geography, the defining distinction we came up with, is that differential performance, and is that notion that, you know, the standard includes the notion of providing a copy of the IP and providing, you know, granting those rights initially. And in our view, when you took the Europe-Japan type scenario in Issue 2 and you took the time renewal scenario in Issue 1, there was a difference there. That was a difference we could grab onto and say, here's what the difference is. I have given you everything you're going to get under the time scenario. I have not under the geography scenario. You can poke holes in that, but that is the distinction we saw, and I want to make sure that's clear. Whether you agree with it or not, that was the distinction we saw.
And I think what I heard is people are struggling to understand that difference, and so you've told me that same thing for 4 or 5 months now, and I still don't understand the difference, so I'm not sure reiterating it is necessarily going to convince us. And I get the theory. I think people, and I heard it relatively unanimously, whether you think it should be A or B, people struggling with why is time different from other attributes. And I think that's the fundamental struggle people are having, and I think if we're going to head that way, as opposed to trying to say it is so clearly different, it's just saying it's different because we said so. Now, I'm not saying that's the right answer to do it, but I think we'd be better off, as opposed to explaining a theory, just saying you treat time differently because we said you treat time differently. Scott?
I'll be the first to be somewhat supportive of the paper, perhaps. I think I can do this. I think I can see the difference. I can apply these answers, and I can explain to an individual person why his or her situation gets the answer that's laid out here. I think Alan has identified and stated why time is different, because we have this model where we have to decide whether it's over time or point in time. And so time has already affected the way we analyze these things, regardless of whether there is a time limit in the license. That is to say, even a license with no time limit, we will consider whether to recognize it at a point in time or over time. So we've already kind of taken time into account once, and when it's also an aspect of the license, it makes it hard and confusing and difficult. So I understand why time might be different, and I think I can apply these answers. I don't know if they're the best answers that we could come up with. I think I could also apply the other answer to Issue 1. And to Cullen's point about structuring, I'd have thought that a modification that lops off 6 months under the original contract and then adds it on to the renewal so that there is you continue to use it for the same year that you already had the right to, I'd have said, no, that your modification is adding the second 2 years, not lopping off the 6 months in the first and adding that to the second as well. So I wouldn't have allowed that structuring to achieve the goal it's apparently intended to achieve, if you went with that view. But I think this is doable to some extent. Jim, I think you're right. Maybe it's a matter of it's different because we said it's different. Same reason why royalties on licenses of IP, you don't estimate, because we said you don't estimate. I was on a panel with PK a few months ago, and he said the same thing. He said, stop asking why. We have no answer for why. It just is. And maybe this is one where that's the way it has to come down.
And I don't mean that come across as negative when I say that. I think you've explained it. You can get behind that, but if you can't accept it, it's because we said so.
Well, the alternative, though, would be to rewrite the restrictions language and don't put time in that listing. we say restrictions of time, geographic, or region, or use are attributes of the contract. And regardless of whether it's recognized over time or at a point in time, it says there. It seems to me if we're going to treat time differently, we have to take time out of that list.
Well, or maybe what we mean is that a time restriction that limits you to certain portions of the year is an aspect of the license, but a time restriction that cuts you off forever, well, that's different. And when we change that, that is another item.
That sounds like complexity.
Oh, and it's easy now.
Right.
Maybe in part to respond to one of the comments that was made about changes to contracts. I think it's important to also remember we're talking about the scenarios where there hasn't been a change, but there's a restriction built in that might affect my use of it. And you know, it's a pharmaceutical product that I can begin using in a specific geography at a specific date. Might maybe time to coincide with when the regulatory approval will come online or something like that. But there are also, you know, all sorts of, you know, indications that it might be used for, and that might be changing during the course of a contract. So the need to think, as we think about these things, I'm not so concerned about the modifications and how we deal with those. Obviously, that's a knock-on implication, but it's also the base contract that has restrictions that are not the same throughout the contract, which is, if I'm reading the signals right from the staff in terms of what's been in the fatal flaw versions of the U.S. exposure, the U.S. Amendments, where you have Class A and Class B products, and the beneficiary can begin using them at different dates. I guess it concerns me because I don't know how far to take that. I mean, if those Class A and Class B products are, say, an iPhone 6 and an iPhone 6 Plus, does that matter? Does it matter to the licensor that the licensee has, you know, is using it in a different way in a different period? Does that really matter? And we can debate this, and people have different views on it. But at the end of the day, when do those restrictions really determine a separate performance obligation? And I think, you know, I guess I would suggest if there's no ability to sort of to figure out what the principle is here, I think trying to do it by examples is just never ending. I think we'd be better off just stopping and, you know, just letting practice deal with it, however it deals with it, acknowledging that it may be diverse, because I think in a lot of sectors they want to treat restrictions as just elements of a contract and not start to break apart an individual license.
So your last point, and you know, I do think, regardless of this discussion, we're going to have, you know, some level of, you know, diversity in practice unless we go through every one of those iterations and you wind up with then the potential for conflicting outcomes. And so I think your point about letting practice deal with it has largely been what happens today in many areas, particularly outside of software, where there isn't even a structure that provides the starting point necessarily that we have today. So just keeping this in the frame of reference of at least we have a starting point. I think we can think about whether this improves it, but it isn't a wide open field. And I think we're talking about, can you get, you know, sort of a theory for whether time is or isn't different and why, but that, you know, we're still in, at least my view, a much better spot than we have in licensing, you know, sort of across the board today. So I just keep that in mind as a frame of reference. Mark?
Jim, I think you just made the point I was going to make. I want to be careful that we don't go backwards. I mean, this license there, I feel like we take 8 steps forward, a couple back, 4 forward. But like Scott said, I think I know what to do here. I think there's not going to eliminate all the diversity. We're still going to have that. There's still going to be a lot of areas where we might have very similar transactions with different outcomes, but I think it'll be a lot less with this or something, whatever clarity you can provide. And as long as we can move in that direction of limiting the diversity, I think that's sort of what we're all trying to get to. Right now, I've seen both view A and B on this topic, and I really can't articulate why one or the other you can or can't do. I think this makes it very clear what you do. So same with issue two. So I think we should hopefully move forward with this, maybe provide more clarity later if there's some outrageous transactions that we're getting vastly different answers. But I certainly support moving forward with this rather than backwards.
I guess I'd sit here with a little bit different perspective in that unlike many people sitting around the table, have not followed this from every minute over the last 10 years, from the pre-exposure draft through the exposure drafts and the basis of conclusions for which there's been references right here, but I'm seeing this more from the private company perspective, and the preparers of the financial statements and the auditors of those financial statements that have not had the privilege and the opportunity to be around through all these discussions. And I see people that have been here struggling with it. And I'm concerned with respect to if it's supposed to be a principles-based type standard, and yet we have certain aspects for which we're struggling to come up with a principle that's consistent, how that these smaller firms and smaller companies without the resources are going to respond. And so, you know, if I'm kind of in the camp, if we can't come up with a principle, let's just say that we're unable to come up with a principle and this is the rules and this is how we're going to do it, and quit asking as to what the principle is because we don't have one.
So we talked about issues one, and I don't know if we've covered people's points on two, but I think
Jim, I've got one more comment over here. Jim, I've got one more comment here, if I could, Phil.
Sure.
I'll be brief. I know a lot of this discussion has been about why are these different. But I'm coping less well than most other people. I'm not even sure I know what I'm supposed to do. It's not a question of why I'm doing it. I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do, particularly when I think about time, particularly when I go beyond software into other licenses like film licenses, TV rights, that sort of thing. So I'm just genuinely confused, and I don't find any of the answers in the paper particularly objectionable, but I don't have great faith in my ability to get to the same answer as other people. So some more help would be much appreciated.
On to,
I'm not sure where we're on.
I mean, to some extent, issues two and three were always related. I feel like we've talked about issues one through three. Would anybody, and we can ask, maybe ask them, do you feel like we just talked about one through three, or did we talk about one through two? Is there more? I don't know whether we think we had planned to tee it up one way. In hindsight, the two issues were related, so we talked about them together. So I'm just trying to figure out where we are. Does anybody have any other comments about issues two and three, if I was to assume we're going on to issue four? There's no one here.
So just before we move on, I just did have one observation or perhaps a question to the groups here and in the US. As we had that discussion, I felt most people started, their core concern was difficulties in distinguishing the time case from the geography and use case. And I just wanted to maybe it would be helpful to confirm just how deep that difficulty lies. Were people broadly saying that they agreed with the geography and use case but found it difficult to reconcile the time case? Or were people saying that the tension between the two of them made it very, very difficult to conclude on any of the cases? That seems to be quite an interesting distinction, because if we're kind of there on geography and use, and it's really a time issue, that feels like a different outcome from just having a difficulty with the time issue.
So for myself, I can understand the geography issue. I know that's not necessarily what I would have chosen, but it makes perfect sense to me. I don't find it difficult. I then find it difficult to say, okay, now where does that leave me with time? Particularly if I'm allowed to use something for, say, 3 years and then not at all for 2 years and then again for another 4 or 5 years. No idea.
Maybe in response to your question, I could get to the answer in the geography case, but I didn't know why the other answer was not the correct answer. And that's where I was battling.
So it's the tension. Andrew?
I think in the photography one, I felt a bit more comfortable with it, probably because I then started thinking about some different industries or different sectors. So, for example, let's say I've got an insurance policy that covers the UK, and then in 2 years' time it'll cover continental Europe as well. I don't have very much trouble seeing that as something where I have two distinct things. And if I take that back into issue two, that was something which perhaps I felt a little bit more comfortable with. In terms of the time-based one, I can see how you get to the answer, and I think I can understand the mechanics of it, but I find it difficult to reconcile the way that time works with the geography one.
Tony?
Much the same. I'm still not sure why I'm told that restrictions don't matter and then I'm told that they do. I've sort of listened to all of the debate and I'm still not clear why in some cases they do and some cases they don't. I understand how you can construct an argument that you get to the answer you get to for usage and geography, but then I continue to struggle with the time answer in that context. So I'm not sure it's simply the tension between the two. In my mind, it goes deeper than that. And if the idea is that we're going to apply step two, then I'm not sure we should be told that restrictions don't matter. Maybe the solution is simply apply step two to decide whether these are distinct using the principle that sits there.
Can I jump in, Ian?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think maybe another way to articulate the same thing is it seems like in issues one and three, you're dealing with modifications to a contract that's already in existence. And in issue three, the staff is saying, well, follow the modification guidance. Issue one, it seemed like the staff wasn't saying follow the modifications guidance. In issue two, it seemed that we were talking about things that were in the original contract, but we've deemed them to be distinct based on step mm-hmm. two. So I'm all in favor of following the model overall. And if it's the modification guidance, follow the modification guidance. You still might have to decide whether it's distinct or not. And we still have to come to the conclusion about whether you think time is a distinct element within there. But I think there are, I think that there are spots in the model to look to. And it doesn't have to be as complicated as I feel like we're making it. I don't know if that helps.
I suppose the reason I asked my question, usually I tend to find myself arguing for things that work in theory and don't work in practice, and I was trying to understand the extent to which this works in practice and doesn't work in theory. And I wonder if, to a reasonable extent, it works in practice for geography and use, and the real issue is time. Which is maybe a different way of summarising the issue than just saying it's all unfair.
Okay, Jim, that's our comments here. I think we're issue saying we've gone through issues two and three, haven't we?
Yep.
We're
yeah.
agreeing that.
All right, so turning to issue four. to some extent, it's important to note this issue was submitted separately from the other issues in the paper. However, the staff decided to include this discussion together with the other issues in this paper, principally because some of the key themes we described earlier also influenced the discussion of this issue. Some TRG members and others have expressed since the TRG paper was posted that the staff do not clearly opine on the stakeholder views other than to say that we reject view C. That is, the staff have not expressed whether they believe view A or view B to be appropriate to the examples D through F that are in the paper that were presented by the submitter. This is because the staff thinks the facts and circumstances presented do not answer what we would view to be the key question, which is whether each user seat is a separate license. As alluded to in the discussion of the key themes, the staff think it should be clear that if a customer has an option to acquire additional licenses, There is no basis in the standard for treating a customer option to acquire a license, whether it's a first license or an additional license, differently from a customer option to acquire any other good or service. Therefore, the key question in examples D through F and similar examples that would arise, of which the staff are familiar that there's a wide variety of these, is whether the contract provides for a single license or multiple licenses with an option to acquire further licenses. This question is universally acknowledged as being significantly judgmental under existing accounting, including in, all of the interpretive guidance that's out there, and the staff think it may be so in many cases under the new revenue standard as well. And many of the same considerations would remain relevant to making that judgment. That is, a lot of those considerations are not specifically linked to guidance that has now been superseded. Paragraph 52 of the TRG paper provides some considerations the staff think relevant to answering that question. An example similar to D through F, the staff are not sure whether the answer would always be that there are multiple licenses or not. But if there are, the customer option material right guidance would apply. The staff rejected view C because we don't think the distinction between whether the customer can produce the copy of the software or the entity must produce the copy is substantive in a multiple license scenario, given the second key theme we described now a long while ago, which is that the licensor's performance includes both making available the intellectual property and granting the rights under the license. If the contract is for multiple licenses, the fact that examples D and E that in examples D and E, the entity does not have to make available any additional copies of the software, does not change its performance in transferring those additional licenses, also includes granting those rights, which does not occur before the customer can begin to use and benefit from them. And that is not affected by which party will produce the copies of the software. So with that, we'll let the group discuss issue number four.
This is an interesting issue in this paper, and I think it. I found myself, my reaction when I read it was, if this is not a usage-based fee in exchange for intellectual property, I'm not sure what is. Meaning, I think it. You know, the staff, the model has an exception, relates to intellectual property that has either sales or usage-based royalties, and this feels to me like it's a usage-based royalty. I've conveyed the IP, and this gets back to the earlier discussions, right? I've conveyed the IP to the customer, and I have usage restrictions on it that says they can use it for 500 times, whatever, and then if they use it more, they pay more. Just felt to me like, if I start to think about that, well, it could have been distinct. Sure, it could have been distinct, but that's not the model. The model is it's IP, and in fact, I've conveyed the IP to the customer. I've done everything I have to do. And I probably don't. I agree with the staff that I wouldn't look at whether I have to provide a key or that they do it themselves. Is there any consequential impact on the accounting? So I would simply look at that. I think it's view B in the paper as a usage-based royalty. Then if I start to introduce optional goods and material rights into the mix, I don't know where I am anymore because I'm no longer in the license side of the model.
Well, let me see if I follow the judgments correctly, Scott, and try to draw out what you described. I think I might have it. My firm, we're really small. We got six people. We buy a license from Microsoft for Microsoft Excel that covers four people, because that happens to be what the base license that Microsoft sells is. And then if we would like to install it on all six of our computers, we can pay an additional per license fee to be able to use six copies of Excel. I believe there you're saying that the option to acquire the additional two licenses would be additional goods and services. Contrast that with we have an accounting system that we run to keep our own books, and we have one license to the accounting system. However, we can also pay extra to allow multiple users to be able to access that system at the same time from wherever they are to enter time. And there, the additional fee we pay is a usage-based fee if we elect to have the opportunity for all six of us to log in at once.
you're asking for my opinion on those. I think that's not. I think we have to back up just a little bit. I think to some extent, what's important to note here is that we just exactly sure what changed. There are multiple license scenarios today. There's guidance everywhere that says sometimes you have a site license or a single license, and sometimes you have multiple licenses. Now, when you have multiple licenses today, you have a nice exception that says you don't have to consider the current GAAP version of the material right guidance, the significant increment discount guidance. We're just not sure, given the same facts and circumstances for the same license, what would make a different decision about what is a usage-based fee, which albeit is not a defined term, we simply say sales and usage-based fees, versus a multiple license scenario today, tomorrow. We acknowledge that if you conclude that something is for multiple licenses, which at least in your first example about the additional Excel seats, or I'll give you an example that I've had in the past where a company has, you know, the number of seats that they use directly affects how many customers they can serve. So they pay a user-based fee for what they do. In that scenario, if you conclude you have multiple licenses, now you are going to have to ask whether there is a material right with respect to the ability to purchase option licenses. Now, that is a difference because TPA 50 is now gone. We just simply looking at there's such a variety of those fact patterns that examples D through F did not provide, let's say, enough to cover off all the different ways you can twist this. There is a lot of judgment involved in making that determination, single license or multiple license today. There will be tomorrow, we believe. And our point was that if you conclude that there is multiple licenses today, that may lead you to the same answer tomorrow. If you do, you'll write guidance just as you would for the option to purchase any other additional goods or services. That's sort of all we are saying through progression of this. We do not have, you know, a set category of here's the exact line at which you're going to cross over from usage-based fee to user-based multiple license fee. There's just too many varieties of those scenarios to try.
All right, but you act like that determination was being made under current literature, but it wasn't, because we don't care if it's a usage-based fee or additional licenses, we're not going to peek ahead anyways.
There's guidance that speaks to that. If people haven't been required to make that determination, but I'm not familiar with that.
Scott, your point is, while there was guidance, there was no distinction in outcome, so you didn't have to think about it.
Right.
I think this all goes back to issue one of the first paper. Am I an option purchaser? Am I in? Did I already sell them the software, like you said, on the server? It's there. It's just a matter of usage. I have to, I guess, installing another instance with maybe a gray area. But you know, are there two? Are those sort of distinct? I think. You know, I can say if you say okay, you can use SAP and. At this plant, we had installed it there, and then you say if you want to use it at some other plant, maybe that's like we go back to what we were just talking about. Maybe that's a distinct good or service in the arrangement. We say that's UA. You know, if it's just adding license, I know it's a fine line, but I think it's just a fine line is issue one of the first paper we discussed. So we said we're going to use judgment there. I think too. I think in a lot of cases, in the example you just said, I don't think you get different accounting answers, except maybe. Deep material right, but
I wasn't troubled, Scott, by where you drew the line, appreciating that you could have iterations at any level in between. I thought you drew it personally at a spot where it was relatively clear in my mind, at least. That
I just tried to figure out real life examples that all the way. So.
Right. At least in my mind, it was the one you sort of very clearly had. As you articulated it, one license, and you could hook up another terminal or hook up your iPad, or however you're reporting your time. The other one is I bought software out of the box, and if I want to use the same, you know, in the old world, the same CD, I got to pay each time I put it on another computer, and it's a new license, I think.
I think our reaction to the paper was that it didn't seem, it seemed nonsensical to us to conclude that, hey, every time I might use software more, it's no such thing as an option. It's always a sales and usage-based fee. So if we're trying to think about how we might maybe distinguish, I think we've talked elsewhere at this meeting and on other occasions about focusing on what is the present enforceable right of the customer to the software, and what is our enforceable right to payment under the terms of the contract. And if it, under the terms, it appears that the customer would be making an independent purchasing decision to expand the boundaries of its right to use the software, then to us that strikes us as an option. If instead it's a circumstance where you have the right to use the software, but due to circumstances outside their control, for example, you know, transactions that are run through the software, or actions by downloading, you know, more of the software, and the result the customer incurs an additional fee, then that would more like a usage-based fee. And there could be some judgment, but we think in, you know, concluding that, oh, well, there's no, for software, there's no such thing, an option, just doesn't seem consistent with the principle. But, wow, what a great industry, you know? That's awesome.
I just wanted to mention that in looking at this, I had thought similar to what Brett had said. I would have gone with B-type approach. But as I reflected back on paper 48, as Mark mentioned, it seems as though there is some consistency in the type of thought process that you ought to go through in terms of identifying options versus variable considerations. So just wanted to indicate that kind of combination of what Brett said and then what Mark said, I think, would make sense for us.
Yeah, it's interesting to take these issues today, mortality, that, you know, the, there's an example in the optional good paper around a delivery of a machine with a usage-based fee that it concludes that since I already delivered the machine, the usage-based fee is just variable consideration. But now I have the same construct in my mind, at least as I think about licenses. If my view is, look, I've delivered the license, if software in this case is a license and I've delivered it, then I'm done performing. You know, there might be some incidental thing I have to do with the key, whatever, but I'm not, probably not going to look at that terribly material in the context of the contract. So I've got this delivery of the IP, the customer controls it, and now there's a usage fee that's being paid, or in this case, a royalty, or whatever you want to call it. So I think these issues all sort of, you know, if you think of them together, if that license is in fact already been transferred to the customer, and they're just defining usage now, and that's going to define how much they're going to get, then you know, if you're informed that way, if you think of that additional usage as just a characteristic of the license, then puts you more in the usage-based fee sort of mindset. Again, it's also sort of down this path of it's a separate model, right? I have a license model that has these exceptions. Doesn't treat it as a reservation. It treats it as a you know, unearned fee.
But what if it's usage in U.S. but they have to pay this additional fee in Germany and it doesn't come into effect until 2 years later? Would that be different?
If your principle is I've already delivered the IP, these just characteristics of usage that I'm going to customer, then I think it falls in line. It's just a usage. It's another form of a usage-based fee. It happens to be a big one in that case.
Okay.